Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Is Seattle in a housing bubble? Can you know you're in a bubble when you're in a bubble? We'll take a look at that in just a few minutes. I hope you can stay tuned. First, though, our top story today. If you have walked around Capitol Hill lately, you might have seen big signs on telephone poles. Boycott Lost Lake Cafe, they say, with a screenshot of an article about rape accusations against cafe owner Dave Minard. The article is by KUOW's Sydney Brownstone, who's been following that story, and this morning published a second article at our website. Sydney Brownstone, thanks for coming in again.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Dave Minard is a very influential person in Seattle. Not all of us know who he is, though. Would you remind us who he is?
Sure. So David Minard is a longtime fixture in Seattle's nightlife and political scene. He's launched several successful bars and restaurants on Capitol Hill and elsewhere. He ran the Capitol Hill Block Party for several years, and he's well known for chiming in on many issues affecting small business owners. The $15 minimum wage, for example, head tax. He got to start looking into the teen dance ordinance, if you remember that.
Yeah.
And he's been a longtime supporter of Dow Constantine, too.
And Sydney, how did you come to be reporting on these allegations?
Well, the first accuser I got a tip about when I was still working at The Stranger through connections through my coworkers. But I eventually found four more women with similar stories, and I published a piece detailing those allegations, for which the five women in total remained anonymous. And after that piece published, six more women came forward with their stories.
Right. What has been the fallout from this so far for Dave Minard, for his business interests?
So this was totally unintentional, but the first piece published during the week of Capitol Hill Block Party. So in the days following that, musicians were getting up on stage and making comments about rape culture. But a series of posters, as you mentioned, went up around Capitol Hill, and Dow Constantine and Jay Inslee divested themselves of David Minard's political donations. Minard's former business partner, Joey Burgess, also announced last week that Minard would no longer have a stake in Lost Lake and the Comet, which were two of his most well-known businesses. He remains the owner of the Five Point Cafe, and as far as I know, he's still invested in a venture on the ground floor of the Gridiron Building.
So you said these first five women whose accounts you published, they wanted to stay anonymous. But this morning, you have published more allegations from six more women, five of whom gave you their full names. What are they saying Minard did?
So like the first five women, they're also alleging a range of behavior. They're accusing Minard of various forms of sexual misconduct, including sexual assault. One woman said that Minard digitally penetrated her while they were having a conversation at a bar and her husband was in the next room. Another woman said that he tried to push her head onto his lap while they were in an Uber with then State Senator Cyrus Habib. The misconduct allegations run the gamut.
What does Dave Minard say about the allegations?
I made multiple attempts to reach David for this story, and he did not respond to more than 50 questions about the new allegations.
In the past, he has said he's made some statements.
Yeah, in the past, we had a long conversation in the offices of Strategies 360, the PR and crisis communications firm he hired to handle these allegations. But this time, he told me to send my questions by email and never responded.
By the way, that crisis communications firm is no longer working with him.
Yes, they dropped Minard as a client after they discovered that one of their own employees had her own Minard story. And she's one of the people who came forward to talk to me in this current story.
So, Sydney, some of these women have accused Minard of violating their consent. But in Washington state, that might not be provable in court. Why is that?
So in Washington state, victims must prove that there was a clear lack of consent. So there's a lot of room to interpret what that means, but it also means that some prosecutors want proof of lack of consent, like a witness who overheard screaming or proof of fighting, scratch marks, shouting, something like that. But there's, in addition to fight or flight, there's a third neurobiological response to trauma called the freeze response, where people just freeze. They're in shock. They don't do anything. So if you responded in that way, if you froze, you would have a tough time proving you didn't consent in court. The burden here, the legal burden, is on the victim and the state.
And that's in Washington state. It's not that way in all states, as you reported.
Yeah. So four states have what one legal researcher called a strict affirmative consent standard. So in other words, a lack of a no doesn't mean a yes. And in these states, the way I understand it is that some of the burden shifts from the victim to the accused to show that they obtained some form of consent, whether it be verbal or physical, body language cues, that kind of thing.
And which four states are those?
They are Montana, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and I am blanking on
Sorry about putting you on the spot, but I thought to ask because I guess I was a little surprised to see Montana or Wisconsin. You know, it just how these things change can really vary internally by state, and I wondered what's happening in Washington State around that.
Yeah, I mean, some of these states had very progressive state laws that were written, but sometimes it's also built up through case law. Like in New Jersey, for example, it was a state Supreme Court case that decided that a lack of a no was not a yes.
Mm-hmm. How important is it that 5 out of the 6 women to come forward today are giving their full names?
It's huge. I mean, as you know, it's been very common for journalism outlets and newspapers over the years to automatically omit the names of sexual assault accusers if they even ran those stories, which typically only covered stories of women who had criminal cases adjudicated in court. And the reason why these newspapers typically omitted the names is because of the stigma attached to sexual violence and the tendency for our society to blame the victim. But in some ways, never putting names on those accusations, never putting pictures on their faces, perpetuates that stigma. So, you know, by having names, by having these women coming forward and identifying themselves, it adds to the transparency of the story. I think it probably adds to their credibility, and it shows that maybe the stigma is beginning to recede.
Yeah, I wondered about that. How did people tell you, you know what, I'm not as scared as I would have been, or did some of the people you talked to, Sydney, say, this is still feels like a huge risk for me?
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely... I guess the dam kind of broke with the first story, but the women who came forward in the second story were still scared because it's their names on the line, it's their reputations on the line. But at the same time, several of the women kind of veered back and forth over the reporting process between one woman said, I'm not ashamed, and then thinking about everything that could be lost at the same time. So,
how about the reactions they've gotten from the people around them? Did they express any surprise at what has happened when they've told, in some cases, romantic partners or friends, colleagues?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people already knew about these allegations going back years, and that was an important part of the reporting for this piece, talking to people who had heard about this long before the first story published. So I think from some people close to these women, they had already known for a very long time. In certain scenes, people knew for a very long time about these types of allegations. But in terms of the bigger response, it's been pretty supportive of the women telling their stories.
So I guess we should talk about for whom this kind of reporting is more difficult. Like what kinds of people maybe have more to fear by coming forward than other people?
I mean, I think it cuts both ways. I think it depends. I think that if you are a successful business person and your name is well known, you have a lot to lose. But at the same time, if you're successful and you use your name, that adds to your credibility. People may be more willing to believe you if you are, for all intents and purposes, a nobody and you use your name. People can kind of project all sorts of motivations onto you that may not be there. So I think that there are risks in both directions depending on your stature in society.
Mm-hmm. KUOW's Sydney Brownstone has been reporting on this ongoing string of sexual assault and misconduct allegations against Seattle restaurateur and music scene member Dave Meinert. And again, this morning, fresh accusations were published. You can read the story at our website. Sydney, thanks for the update.
Thank you, Bill.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're going to be right back. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Seattle's real estate bidding wars, they're notorious, right? Sellers closing the deal in a week, no strings attached, multiple bidders willing to pay 10%, 20% over asking price. Seattle home prices have climbed 13% in the past year. However, the economic winds seem to be blowing cooler. So what's happening here? Let's ask the director of the Washington Center for Real Estate Research at the University of Washington, James Young, and the economic research director at Zillow, Aaron Terrazas. Welcome to the both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Hi.
James, first, at University of Washington, I'm hearing about Seattle area homes actually taking, oh my gosh, weeks to sell, not days or hours. Why is this beginning to happen?
Well, I think there's a lot of different things going on, particularly in the Seattle market. A lot of people are wait and see, and a lot of the anecdotal evidence seems to be pointing to some headwinds in the upper end of the market and the slowdown in terms of supply. There's no supply for first-time buyers. So as those market dynamics take hold, then it leaves very little sort of room for house prices to grow. People can't move up the ladder because they can't sell their well, they can sell their properties, but not to first-time buyers. You're stuck with a limited supply of housing in the lower end of the market. So it makes it more difficult for the housing ladder and the housing continuum to move up rapidly. So any small headwind at all means that you go back to normality fairly quickly, simply because those dynamics are gummed up a little bit.
And what might those headwinds be? I've heard many theories, interest rates and taxes and trade wars and what's happening in China. What do you think is happening in the local market?
Well, I think in the local market, you've got several things that you've got. Well, the ability to write off taxes on local taxes on the federal tax return and so forth creates a headwind for those marginal buyers that would have to pay more than $10,000 in property taxes. So that could possibly slow down the upper end of the market on the lower side of things. Also, a lot of the headwinds are regulatory, where it takes a long time for development to come on board. There's a lot of rental housing being built out there, but hardly any condominiums in the suburbs, which is what you would expect to see in most cities at this point in the mature stage of a cycle. You'd want to see a lot of, you know, starter homes that are condominium units in the suburbs. You're not getting that at all in Seattle.
Okay, taxes, regulations. Let's check in with Aaron Terrazas at Zillow. What are your thoughts on why the Seattle area market seems to be cooling when it comes to these overheated price rises?
You know, I think when we talk about cooling, it's important to put it in perspective.
Yeah.
We're a little bit spoiled in this area in that the housing market has been so hot. Home values, you know, according to our data in the Seattle metro, are still appreciating around 11% year over year. Now that's down from 16% at the start of the year. So, you know, a little bit slower, but compared to the rest of the country, it's still growing very quickly. You know, for the first time in June, in about 2 years, City of Seattle home values kind of grew at the same pace as metro home values, so the slowdown has been particularly pronounced inside the city. The city has been, for several years, the driver of the region's housing market. But, you know, there are only right now three or four markets nationwide that are seeing faster home value appreciation. Now, Seattle's no longer number one on that ranking like it was for 2 or 3 years. But it's still faster than the vast majority of parts of the country.
Yes, thank you. Let's put slowdown in quotes there. I want to ask both of you how this situation, a real estate market that has inflated, how is this like or not like the housing bubble that popped about a decade ago, James?
Well, I think that there are a lot of different fundamental factors, particularly in the Seattle market, where you have a lot of demand coming from people moving into the area, high employment, and lots of demand in particular price brackets with the IT sector and everything else. I think that when you looked at what was going on before, it was the availability of financing, the ease of financing, which led to a lot of speculation in the housing market. And it kind of got away from fundamental demand. I think most economists would describe a house price bubble as when house prices move beyond what the fundamental demand factors would indicate. And in Seattle, you still have very strong fundamental demand factors, lots of inward migration, lots of well-paying jobs being created. So I don't think this, let's put it this way, every time is different, but it kind of rhymes with the last one. And everybody expects it to rhyme with the last one. I don't think that's the case this time. You have a lot of fundamental demand in the Seattle area. So that would be my take on it.
Aaron, you agree?
That's right. You know, there's no doubt kind of this region and this region is emblematic of the nation as a whole are facing kind of its own housing market and housing crisis. But it's a very different type of crisis than what we saw in 2004, 2005, 2006. It's a supply side crisis, a crisis where interest rates have been low. You know, kind of there is kind of that pent up rental demand, renters who have delayed buying their first homes, although that's waning. So there is demand out there. Supply has not kept up. And, you know, we really right now are facing a supply-side crisis. A decade and a half ago, it was kind of boosted by demand and easy mortgage lending, as James said.
Okay, so then James talked about there is demand. There actually is people moving in. Employment is strong. So how much would it take to change that? For example, when Amazon started talking about an HQ2 and started objecting to a tax that Seattle passed that Amazon would pay, a lot of people started wondering, what if Amazon decided to focus its job growth someplace else, whether it's Amazon or something else? Possibilities do you see? I'll start with James for a change in the fundamentals for housing prices here.
Well, that's the whole issue, is that demand can always change a lot more quickly than housing supply. And developers, once they start putting supply in motion, you can't stop it. You just can't stop at some point and say, okay, that supply is not coming on board, because you have to forward plan about 2, 3, 4, sometimes 5 years in advance on a real estate development. So the supply overhang is what creates a problem. So if demand stops, then you've got this supply overhang, and that's going to drive prices down, because the supply being out there, it's got to sell. They're going to find a clearance price somewhere. And so that's what creates a lot of problems. And we saw that in the last crisis, is when demand quit, you had a lot of oversupply in several markets. So that's what happens. It's just that fundamental mismatch between how quickly supply can change, or how quickly supply can't change, and demand can change very quickly. So that's your problem. That's really it in a nutshell.
How immune do either of you think the Seattle area would be to a national recession, which, you know, it's been a while, and some people, I think some Zillow research pointed to the possibility of a recession in 2020. Aaron, how is that what you think, and how immune do you think Seattle area would be?
You know, if there's one rule in economic forecasting, is that the longer out you go, the cloudier the horizon becomes.
Yeah.
So, you know, 2020 is still a long ways off. No one can say, you know, I hardly know what I'm going to have for breakfast 2 days from now,
right,
much less what's going to happen in the American economy 2 years from now. That said, you know, when you look at the history of economic cycles, this is one of the biggest, longest expansions in American history, and at some point it will run its course. There are a number of risk factors that economists typically point to, things like trade risks, things like Federal Reserve kind of hiking interest rates more quickly than the economy can withstand. So you know, those are the risks that I think, you know, anyone kind of should continue watching. You know, it's not necessarily that they're imminent and going to happen tomorrow, but you know, it's worth keeping your eye on. As to whether or not this region can withstand kind of an economic downturn, this is a fairly kind of trade-dependent region that kind of is economically integrated with the rest of the country. You know, a lot of our kind of booming companies, be it Amazon, be it Zillow, kind of depend on consumers around the country. So, you know, certainly what happens, you know, in Nashville or Dallas or anywhere else in this country is important for the Seattle region.
Okay, we're coming to the end of our time here, so let me get to advice. You might be an owner who wants to sell at just the right time, or you might be someone who wishes they could buy or would like to buy and thinks maybe prices are starting to fall. Maybe they'll fall faster. What advice do you have to buyers and sellers, James?
It depends upon what you want to do. Academic economists especially in real estate markets, make the worst dinner guests, because somebody will say, oh, my house has this and this, what do you think it's worth? And of course, the first thing an academic economist is going to say is, are you going to sell? And then if the answer is no, and I said, well, then it's an academic question. So it depends upon what you want to do in your lifestyle. If you're trying to time a market, real estate is a really bad thing to do, because it's notoriously illiquid and it's difficult to sell exactly when you want to sell. So, you know, my advice would be, if you're happy with where you live, you want to be there, stay there. If not, then sell and realize what capital gains you can. You just have to realize there may not be an option out there for you in terms of what lifestyle you want. That would be my advice. Financialization of real estate can be a real problem unless you're a professional at it.
Okay, advice besides don't invite James Young to dinner. Aaron, and I'm thinking also of would-be buyers. Like, you might think, hey, these selling can start to lead to selling. Maybe other people will jump in and say, uh-oh, it's peaked. It's sell time. Maybe I should, you know, is there strategy advice for a buyer?
Sure. In general, I generally agree with the point, you know, don't try to time the market if you're a seller or a buyer.
Okay.
You know, sell because you're retiring, because you need a bigger house. Buy because you're starting a family, because you're moving. You know, those are the reasons you should be making these enormous financial decisions with your life, not because of a marginal change in buyer-seller conditions. And as I said, it's still, you know, if you're a buyer out there, it's still a seller's market, maybe less of a seller's market than it was 2 or 3 months ago, but it's still very much a seller's market. It's still competitive. Prices are still appreciating at 11% a year. That's, you know, five times the rate of wage growth. So, you know, maybe you have less pressure to make multiple offers, can be a little bit pickier, but you know, important to keep in mind where the cards lie at this point.
Okay, I'd have you both to dinner. Aaron Taraz is Economic Research Director at Zillow. James Young, Director of the Washington Center for Real Estate Research at University of Washington. Thanks to the both of you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW. Speaking of housing, let's give you a little taste of the home show last night. Pearl Jam's first home show at Safeco Field, one of two benefit shows to combat homelessness. This is the first show Pearl Jam's played in Seattle in 5 years. And during the concert, the lead singer, Eddie Vedder, took a few moments to tell a story about a man that he knew almost 30 years ago.
This next song was written by a guy I used to hang out with when our office was started out in Pioneer Square. We were making the first record, and we were down there every day. And there was a guy that lived in one of the foyers, and then in the middle of the day, he kind of take his grocery cart and hang out in the deal, and I would get him the same sandwich that I would get, and he just looked interesting, so we started having these hangout conversations, you know. And his name was Eddie, and he was a large African-American man who kind of took to wearing like a blue tarp most of the time. And some of you might even remember him, and he had a shopping cart. But he always had a globe sticking out of it, you know. So we'd talk, and he was a Vietnam vet. So we'd spend time, and he'd kind of show me, you know, he'd have these good moments, and he'd tell me these stories about what he'd been through and some of the atrocities he had seen. And then other days, he wasn't there. And it was, I could see him fighting with his mind and his own experiences, and he didn't, obviously wasn't getting help, or the resources weren't there, or he had been too far gone. We came back from European tour, and after knowing him for about a year and a half, and I couldn't find him anywhere. And I started asking around, and some of the other folks, and he was under the viaduct, which was great, because I thought I lost my friend. And so we had about a month more of hanging out, and then after the next tour, I came back, and that's when I had really lost him. So the song was written before he passed away, and he never got to hear it, and he never knew that he was part of it. So, and I've never really told that story about him in particular until tonight, because it's the issue that we're talking about, and I think one of the things that could be most important to do is just elevate the understanding and the empathy towards our homeless neighbors. So this one's for Eddie.
Pearl Jam last night heading into a breakneck version of Even Flow and talking about the story behind it at the home show to benefit homelessness. You're listening to KUOW. Thanks for tuning in to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This week, people who want to save Seattle's Showbox Theater came to City Hall. They don't want a developer to turn the 80-year-old downtown concert venue into a high-rise apartment building. One of those testifiers was a man who's played the Showbox dozens of times, Ben Gibbard of the platinum-selling band Death Cab for Cutie. Gibbard lives on Capitol Hill, and his latest single, Gold Rush, just happens to be about the swinging of the wrecking ball. Digging for gold in my neighborhood, where all the old buildings stood, and they keep digging it down and down, so that the cars can live underground. The swinging of a wrecking ball through these laughing plaster walls is letting all the shadows free. And Ben Gibbard is with us in our studio at KUOW. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You didn't know about the plans to knock down the Showbox when you wrote that song.
I didn't, no. At the time, it was a song just that was written about, you know, not only the changes throughout Seattle, but specifically in my neighborhood of Capitol Hill, and just how I've realized that I connect a lot of my memories to the geography of the city. And when these buildings are knocked down or other things are put in their place, one has to reckon with the passage of time. And as my bandmate likes to say, you know, sometimes we put our hard drives of memories in physical places. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's harder to kind of get that information out when the physical space has been demolished.
What's one specific change that found its way into this song or inspired it?
There's so many, but for years, I lived around the corner from Picora's.
The pizza place,
yeah. And it, as, you know, as apartment buildings and condos are going up all around Capitol Hill, there was still this single-story family pizza place on the corner.
Yep.
When they sold that property and it was demolished, that was a particular canary in a coal mine for me, because to me it represented, this is one of the last vestiges of not only, you know, kind of a working-class family establishment on Capitol Hill. Capitol Hill is much more of an adult, young person's neighborhood, kind of always has been. But, you know, Picora's, you'd see little league teams in there and, you know, softball teams when you go in there and grab a pizza or whatever. Yep. Rockers going to shows across the street.
I used to live on Melrose.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, yeah. You know, that one hurt in a particular way.
I want to ask you about the feel of the song, Gold Rush, because it's not like it has a melancholy feel. I hear some ambivalence sneaking in, I think, when I hear the chorus, I guess it is, be this way, please don't change, stay the same. Be this way. I took that as some irony or some self-awareness, like, yeah, I am kind of becoming one of those guys saying, please don't change.
Well, as we were putting the song together, I wanted those lines in the chorus to be almost as if they were, another side of the narrator's consciousness. You know, that there is, I think the verses are very self-aware. I'm very proud of, I believe it's the third verse in the song, 1, 2, 3. Because the third verse in the breakdown says, you know, I've ascribed these monuments a false sense of permanence. I've ascribed these monuments a false sense of permanence. I've placed faith in geography to hold you in my memory. I have done this to myself. No one, you know, Jeff Bezos didn't do this to me.
Yeah.
You know, this is nothing that has been done to me as, you know, the narrator of the song. I have brought this upon myself because of the significance I've placed upon the geography around me. And, you know, I wanted to present the lyrics in the chorus as if they were kind of a more emotional side of the narrator's consciousness that were pleading to please don't change. But, you know, they're kind of airy and soaring in the background. But in I like the fact that I wanted to present the vocals a little grittier so that it feels as if it's kind of coming from a more weathered place. You know, it's the narrator is kind of somewhat weathered, maybe a little older, you know, my age or older, and you know, yet the vocals in the chorus are somewhat very emotional and not so much tethered to, I think, reality in the same way that the verses are.
I was expecting the video to be shot in Seattle. Well, it looks like L.A.
Well, I will tell you, this is, I am not lying when I tell you this. We wanted to shoot the video in Seattle. We could not afford to shoot the video in Seattle.
Why? Why does it cost so much to shoot in Seattle?
I think that's a question for Lynn Shelton and maybe some other Seattle filmmakers. Why Seattle is more expensive to shoot in than Los Angeles? It's I will just diplomatically say it's not as easy to do here as it is in Los Angeles, and it would have been much more expensive. So, you know, my initial thought was like, yes, we need to be walking down, you know, Pike or Pine in Seattle. I mean, this needs to be the scene for this. And we literally, we could not afford to do it here.
Well, whether it's a music venue or a pizza place where you get a slice, talking to Ben Gibbard here of Death Cab, do you ever wonder, am I sliding into middle-aged nostalgia?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, I have to check myself from time to time and wonder if, you know, some of my feelings about my environment are based in my desire to relive my 20s. And I think in most cases, that's not what's driving my feelings on the matter. And I think specifically with the Showbox, you know, I have had so many wonderful evenings at the Showbox throughout my 20s and 30s and even into my 40s. And I want future generations of music fans and performers from this city and beyond to be able to experience this wonderful room as well. It's not, you know, it'd be much easier for people like myself or Duff McKagan or Mike McCready or, you know, Macklemore to just be, oh, that's a bummer. Well, we had great times there, so who cares? Yeah, condos, whatever. We're not even playing there anymore that often anyways. And, you know, I think I know the reason that we all care is because we want to preserve this for future generations so that they can have their experiences there. I've already had my crazy wild nights at the Showbox, you know, and I don't care to relive a lot of them. However, I do want this to be preserved for future generations.
What's so distinctive about the Showbox? It's not a place for unheard of bands like the OK Hotel was, mm-hmm. or the Crocodile breaking new bands. What why does the Showbox mean so much to you?
Well, the Showbox is a really unique venue. Not only is it a place that people in the Seattle area like to go to see shows because of the vantage points from the audience are really great. It holds 1,200 people, but it feels very intimate.
Super intimate.
Really intimate. But I think one thing that, you know, not a lot of people understand is what it means not only to the city but to the country at large. You know, there are a small handful of venues of its size and kind of pedigree that, you know, are institutions in other cities. There's the Fillmore in San Francisco or First Avenue in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. 930 Club in D.C., the Showbox in Seattle. These are venues that, you know, performers, you know, artists, musicians play on a circuit. And when they get to them, you know, they always have great shows. The hospitality is great. The audiences are great. I think anybody who's either played it or gone as a concert goer feels that they're really seeing something special. You know, a show at the Showbox is not just a show at your local bar. It feels like a special event. And because it's about a 1,200 capacity venue, you know, a lot of the acts that are playing there are, you know, they're starting to make a particular rise. And for some acts, it's the last club that they're going to play. So for some acts, it's the biggest club they're ever going to play.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, because
it's
of
on
that,
to theaters next.
Yeah, but it is a very interesting size that is both feels intimate, yet also it feels like a real stepping stone in one's career.
Or stadiums, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, not many people can pull off the stadiums anymore. But you know, Pearl Jam is, of course. But So I think that's one thing that I've really wanted to press upon people as this conversation kind of unfolds about saving the Showbox is that this is not just our venue. This is a venue that is part of a legacy of not like-minded venues, but similar venues around the country that are very special to the artists and performers that get to stop off at them.
You know, some people are saying we need high rises in the city. That's part of the more living housing units, the more the price gets affordable. Does that enter in for you?
I don't think that argument holds in this particular case. You know, the Seattle Times had a story a couple of months ago that was kind of investigating vacancy rates down in Belltown, and they determined that roughly 26% of the high-end rentals in Belltown were vacant. So this isn't, in my opinion, this isn't an issue of we need more housing. We certainly need more affordable housing in the city. But I don't kind of buy the argument that, you know, what the city needs is 44 stories of luxury condominiums because we have so many vacancies in the city of properties that are, one can only assume, are kind of created for people at a certain income bracket. And no part of the Oney Group's development scheme is to provide low-income housing. I mean, obviously, they have to. They either have to provide units in their building, which they are absolutely not going to do, or provide the city with a cash payout, which, you know, may sound like a lot of money, but in the grand scheme of what the city is spending on affordable housing, is really a drop in the bucket. So we certainly need more housing in this city. I don't think anybody's denying that. But if we have innumerable high-end rentals and condominiums that are sitting vacant in this particular neighborhood, I don't see how adding more is going to solve that problem.
We were talking on KUOW last week about the drive to save the Showbox and the drive to preserve Seattle's soul. And one of my guests, the journalist Erica C. Barnett, warned us about nostalgia. I want to know what you think of this. Mm-hmm.
When you're in your 40s, you will look back on the time when you were in your 20s. For me, it was Austin in the 90s. Man, that was the best.
Like, that was the coolest.
That was Austin, the coolest the time that it's ever been. It sucks now, and everybody's boring, and there's nothing good there. But of course, like some part of that is you wish you were in your 20s. And, you know, people are in their 20s now having a different experience. And there's light rail. People can connect to more parts of the city than they've ever been able to connect to without driving a car. There's art spaces all over the city that weren't there. Now, they might not be in the areas where you remember them from when, you know, from the 90s or the 2000s. But, I mean, my concern about specifically things like the Showbox and, you know, changing our historic preservation laws so we can say this has to be a music venue or a bookstore or a record store or a video store in perpetuity forever is that, like, that's great if we want the city to be a museum for people my age. But and so I'll always be able to go to Scarecrow Video and I'll always be able to go to Finney Books and I'll always be able to go to, you know, name your favorite place. But people who are in their 20s will have less opportunities and less spaces to create a city for them.
What's your take on that?
I understand her point of view, but I think in as it pertains to the Showbox, I think it certainly sells the venue's cultural significance, you know, very short. You know, I have been at shows at the Showbox in my 20s and my 30s, and I was there just a month ago seeing a show. It's a place that people of all ages congregate, from the all ages shows that they do there to a show I saw last year, you know, 1,200 people with gray hair pogoing. And I don't go to the Showbox, and I don't think a lot of people go to the Showbox to try to relive their 20s, but to participate in the experience of live music in a venue that has meant a lot to them and continues to mean a lot to them, and you also see meaning a lot to young people who are going there for the first time. I absolutely agree with Eric in the sense that there are punk rock venues that are occurring right now that I'm too old to know about.
And they don't want you there.
They don't want me there. I look like a narc, you know. So they don't want me there, and that's fine. These are spaces that are catering to this particular age group, and I think that that's very true what you said. However, I think to assume that people want to save the Showbox because they want to relive an earlier time in their life is, I think, selling a lot of people in the city short. And I think is making some, borderline offensive suggestions as to what their motivations are for wanting to save the place. I don't want to relive my 20s. I don't want to relive my 30s. I want to be in this moment right now. But in this moment right now, you know, I want to go to a place that feels special and has history, not history that I have history with, but has history for decades before I even knew it existed. And you know, I think that one of the issues we tend to have in Seattle, we've had from the very beginning, is because the city is such a relatively young city, we have difficulty recognizing what is worth saving and what isn't. And it's easy when it's, oh, this is Pioneer Square. This is the historic area of town. The buildings are all brick. You know, let's draw a line around that, save that. But, well, this building was built in the 50s. I don't know. You know, we could knock that down and put four townhouses there. I don't know if that really kind of, qualifies. And, you know, I think that that is one of the curses of living in such a young city is that we don't, you know, our history is so shallow in a lot of our neighborhoods that we don't really have a sense of what's worth saving, what isn't worth saving. But I do think that when almost 100,000 Seattleites sign a petition, you know, they show up at city council meetings. They call their representatives and they share their stories about how important this place is to them. I think if Erica was, in fact, at the city council meeting on Monday, she would have seen the 17-year-old girl that got up and pleaded for city council to save the Showbox because she had seen some of her favorite shows there and she wanted to perform there one day. You know, she saw she would have seen me, a 42-year-old musician who has played there innumerable times, seen shows over the past 20 years there. I wanted to save this place. She would have seen, you know, someone in their 60s getting up and talking about how important the Showbox was at a period even before I was there. So I understand her point. I think it's applicable in certain in certain instances, but I think that the Showbox is a very different element altogether.
Ben Gibbard, Death Cab for Cutie, and the new album comes out this Friday, next Friday?
Next Friday, August 17th, yeah.
Thank You for Today is the name of the album, and great talking with you. Thanks for coming in.
Of course, it was an honor.
And here's an update on that drive to save the Showbox Theater. This morning, three local historic preservation groups announced they have nominated the Showbox for landmark status. That's just one strategy to save the building. The Seattle City Council is expected to vote soon on legislation to temporarily expand the Pike Place Market Historic District to protect the Showbox Theater. Thanks again to Ben Gibbard of Death Cab for Cutie. The new album's called Thank You for Today, and here's a track called Autumn Love. Listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. Is Seattle entering a new space age? This week, NASA awarded six private companies $44 million to develop technology that will help commercialize spaceflight. Among the awardees were Jeff Bezos' space company, Blue Origin, and the United Launch Alliance, a joint venture between Boeing and Lockheed Martin. Washington State is known for aviation, has been for a long time. Where do we fit in the private space race? Joining us to talk about Seattle's role is Tim Fernholz. He covers space and the economy and geopolitics for Quartz. He has a new book, Rocket Billionaires, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the New Space Race. And he joins us from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome, Tim.
Hey, Bill. Good to see you.
Blue Origin is here in the Seattle area. Remind us what they do.
Blue Origin is the space company that Jeff Bezos founded, and they are doing three big things. They're building a rocket that will take people to the edge of space as space tourists, and they also do research in it. They're building a much larger rocket to fly satellites into space, and they're building a powerful new rocket engine for ULA, United Launch Alliance, that Boeing-Lockheed joint venture you just mentioned.
Blue Origin was awarded this contract to develop a moon landing system. Are we going back to the moon?
We sure are, or at least that's what the Trump administration would like to do. They've set policy for NASA to head back to our moon. We have learned a lot more about it since we went during the Apollo program in the 1970s. And now the idea is to go back and keep learning, but to do it a lot more cheaply by using private investment as well. And so we have Blue Origin, which is dedicated. It's on a mission to get millions of people living and working in space. That's the vision 100 years from now. In the meantime, they're working to make it very cheap to go to space and to do stuff on the moon. And these new contracts that you mentioned are all moon-focused. They're to develop a propulsive lander that can take robots down to the moon's surface and a special system of radar to make sure they land in precisely the right spot.
When is a lander going to land on the moon? When will people land on the moon again?
Great question. Everybody wants to know the answer. I would say not for years. Probably not until the early 2020s, mid-2020s. The good news is we're going to see some robot missions taking off maybe next year, but space is very hard to schedule. But what's exciting now is the government is sort of settled on a strategy. And now the space industry in the U.S., including a lot of the companies here in Seattle, are sort of forming up behind it. And it's the first time we've had a sort of coherent plan to go do something on the moon in quite a while.
How big a deal is the space industry in Seattle?
It's a big deal. Blue Origin is going to be one of the main up-and-coming companies. Bezos is putting $1 billion of that into that company every year. Obviously, you have Boeing here. SpaceX, Elon Musk's space company, has a special facility here in Seattle that's focused on making a satellite network to transmit internet down to Earth. It's going to be a growth industry there.
Should we believe Elon Musk is going to be any better at space than he's been with Tesla?
Yes, I can say with some authority because you can look at the results. SpaceX, you know, it gets a lot of flack for its more extravagant pronouncements, but they are the workhorse right now. They fly more commercial rocket missions every year than any other company, including United Launch Alliance. They are the primary rocket that's carrying supplies up to the International Space Station for NASA, and they are scheduled right now, it's still very much a race, to beat Boeing in flying humans, human astronauts for NASA, into space from the United States for the first time since 2011.
NASA has used private companies, contractors before. What's different about the private aspect of space exploration today?
What's different is that they're letting the companies have more freedom to solve problems for themselves. They're basically treating it, to borrow a term from software, as space as a service. Instead of designing a rocket and hiring a big company to build it, NASA says, we want to carry X amount of things to this place in space, come up with a proposal, and we'll take the lowest bid we think is most effective. And that has been unlocking. It's been making it cheaper for NASA to do more routine things in low Earth orbit so it can turn its sights to exploration in deep space, the moon, Mars, and beyond.
Well, are billionaires doing anything different from what politicians or taxpayers want?
They're not doing anything different from what politicians or taxpayers want, but because they don't necessarily have as much oversight from Congress and because they can focus on space exploration as space exploration and not as a jobs program, which I think some lawmakers do treat it as, they're able to move more efficiently, to take more risk, and to act more decisively than the government. In one sense, what's happening now is these private companies are doing what NASA did in the 60s and 70s and 80s, but doing it an order of magnitude more cheaply. And that's what they hope is going to enable them to actually do business in space and make a lot of money, something that no one has been able to do there so far.
I'm trying to figure out whether, for example, Jeff Bezos is just doing something more cheaply and more nimbly that the government was going to do anyway, or is Jeff Bezos, with his private, his personality, his interests, is he pushing something that wouldn't happen if it weren't for Jeff Bezos?
I think it's something of both, really. Jeff Bezos and Musk as well have a very expansive vision about humanity's future in space. But to get there, they need to accomplish some technological objectives along the way. And working with NASA, getting access to the world-class researchers' minds, decades of experimental data, and getting access to public money through NASA allows them to work together and accomplish the first milestones on the steps to their more elaborate visions. Right now, it's very synergistic. The government is winning from getting cheaper services from these private companies. The private companies are learning how to do stuff in space. You can imagine tensions coming in down the road, but for now, it's beneficial to both sides, I think, is fair to say.
Here's a little of Jeff Bezos talking about his company, Blue Origin.
So over many decades, I believe, and I get increasing conviction with this with every passing year, that Blue Origin, the space company, is the most important work I'm doing.
The most important work. And my guest here is Tim Fernholz, who wrote a book about billionaires funding space travel. Why do they think this is the most important work that they could do?
There's a lot of reasons, starting with science fiction, but I think most broadly they see a world where you need a frontier, and the next frontier for humanity, they would argue, is space. There are cases to be made that by moving heavy industry off of the Earth, we're going to pollute it less and preserve it longer for our species. Obviously, not all environmentalists agree with that. And then there are cases to be made that we need resources, energy in space, minerals in space, and that expanding into our solar system is the human destiny. A lot of people, I think Elon Musk would argue this, and so did Robert Goddard, the inventor of the liquid rocket engine in the 1920s, is that in order to ensure humanity's survival, we can't be dependent on just one planet. That tends to sound a little wild to people today, but these guys are thinking on timescales of tens of hundreds of years and doing the first steps to make those really elaborate visions a reality. The thing to keep in mind about both of them is that they've been told for most of their careers that what they're doing is crazy and not going to succeed and not going to make them a lot of money. And now they're inured to that a little bit. And so these space companies are their next big goals to try and do something to change the world.
Tim, do you think that billionaire space exploration and the coming of space tourism is going to change the rest of us, change our outlook on what's important and what we can be and do?
So, yes, I do think so. I think one thing to keep in mind that I don't think people realize is that we are so dependent on space right now. Every time you use an ATM, do a stock transaction, that is timed by the GPS system. Space is a part of our lives and our computer networks. We just don't notice it. But one thing you talk about when you talk to an astronaut or anyone who's been to space is that perspective of the Earth from orbit is really life-changing. And I haven't been up there yet, so I can't say for sure, but there are a lot of people in this industry who have been to space who see these space tourism gambits, like what Blue Origin is doing with the New Shepard or what Richard Branson is doing with his company Virgin Galactic, that going up to the edge of space and seeing the Earth from that perspective is a life-changing thing. And I guess we're going to have to wait and see. Tickets are going to have to get a lot cheaper than currently forecast for me to check that out. But it promises to change your view of the world.
Well, maybe Tim Fernholz will get an invitation. He covers space and the economy and geopolitics for Quartz. He's written the book Rocket Billionaires, Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and the New Space Race. And he's been talking with us from KQED in San Francisco. It's been a pleasure, Tim. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for tuning in to The Record. Our show is produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimabrempong, Allison Bruzek, Sophie Reed, Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Won't you tune in tomorrow for KOW's Week in Review? Yep, Friday's almost here. We've got the show box and the elections and the Mariners, the top stories of the week and why they mattered. So I hope you can join us tomorrow.